Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law in North Carolina. Today is the first week of January, today January 3rd, 2013, beginning on a high note. Hopefully everyone is feeling good and not succumbing to influenza. I just received a message from the drugstore. Pick up your drugs and get your flu shot. Right. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for listening to these free informative bulletins. And I want to congratulate Alan that on December 20th, that last show we did together has already received 1,188 archive views. And we began together in 10/21. So that would have been October 21, 2010, for our very first show together, The Vaccine and Your Rights in the United States. How long is that, Alan?
Well, it's
can you do the math in your head?
I can. It's over 2 years, and what a great way to finish 2012. And the congratulations goes to each of us, of course, because we both have contributed a lot to the show, and you for supporting its creation in the first place. So congratulations to you as well.
Well, I think this is the type of thing that we have to do. If we really believe something, we can mull it over in our brains. We can think about it. We can brood or stew. We can actually take action. And I know you are out and ahead of the game, and I'm just following your lead on your coattail of letting people know the kinds of things that are happening in their local regional area, in their states, learning about the NVIC. You're telling us what issues are contemporary and to take how to look at these issues and how to take action for ourselves, and if we need any help, to get advice from a professional. I want to thank all of our listeners and our guests who have tuned in today. And if you'd like to share, click the tweet button, put it on Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, wherever you like. And the shows are always recorded and archived for your convenient listening. At any time, you can get the embed code and put it onto your website so you can share it right there. People can stay on your website and listen. You can download it to your mobile device and take it with you. I want to thank all those people who have favorited the show. We get quite a few of those, and then they get an automatic reminder for when the next show is coming up. So we're going to be talking about a bunch of different things that have gone on in the past week or two. And did you want to start us off today?
Well, there, as you say, many, many things for us to address. I thought maybe we could start with that incident concerning nurses at the Indiana University Hospital in Goshen, Indiana. For some reason, that particular incident where, at least according to some reports, 8 nurses were fired because they refused the flu shot. For some reason, that particular story has gone national, and I was actually contacted by Fox News locally here in North Carolina and in New York City as well yesterday, and some other folks around the country asking for information about this, and a couple of my clients who were among those eight have been very outspoken with several local and national news media persons. So for some reason, this particular incident, you know, we didn't see that kind of coverage or interest from the 150 who got fired in Ohio 3-4 weeks ago, but for some reason, the eight in Indiana, that issue has taken off.
What do you think is the difference here in this particular situation? I mean, 150 is a whole lot more than eight. Were the 150 in one area of the country, for instance, like, were these eight in one hospital fired simultaneously? Is it timing? What could be the issue here?
I don't have a clue as to why this particular event with so few has attracted national attention, whereas the other much more voluminous count in Ohio didn't. But I'll take the opportunity to share information about vaccine issue, you know, any chance I can. That's a reasonable
Well, maybe it's saying something about, of course, the social networking and how things go viral. We're talking about virus and influenza and such, but some things can go viral, meaning that they come into wide view of the public, just like the horrendous rape in India, in New Delhi, learning that that is the rape capital of the world. From this one incident, even though rapes are constantly happening there and women are being intimidated, here in terms of what's happening with the hospital employees and how they're being intimidated in a different kind of way, and who is speaking out, who is picking up this news and spreading it around virally on the internet. I had written a couple of notes about this issue, and I have my own questions about this era when skilled medical staff shortages, you know, we're shorthanded in hospitals. Why would they then dismiss some of their most skilled nurses, healthcare workers?
Well, this is coming from the administrators whose position is looking at the bottom line. It's a money issue. It's my understanding that 2% of Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements will be withheld or not paid to hospitals if they don't have 90% of their staff vaccinated. I don't believe this kicks in until some near future point, somewhere in the next couple of years, but they're gearing up for it. So I saw very few, but nonetheless some healthcare workers in my practice a couple of years ago in the fall, and last year I saw several. I may have had a couple or a few dozen at most. But this past fall, late summer through the very early winter, I had about 150 healthcare workers from 25 states. It's just the issue just really exploded this year. And they're looking at that bottom line, and they don't care about any individual person's beliefs or preferences or wishes, and they don't care about whether, from a medical or scientific point of view, the policy makes sense. They care about the fact that they're going to lose money if they don't vaccinate their employees. So there's a strong incentive on the part of the hospitals to impose mandates. They haven't all done that, but more of them are doing that, and I expect we'll see even more doing it next year. But strong incentives or mandates, and to create exemption policies that are as restrictive as possible. Now, there are a lot of different parts and pieces to this. For one thing, there's a federal law right. Now, there's not a state law right in most states to refuse vaccines in the workplace. The state exemption laws that people are familiar with and talk about apply to students in schools. So most of the time, you've got to fall back on federal law and Title VII, Roman numeral VII. Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964 requires employers to accommodate their employees' religious beliefs and practices. And what qualifies under that is potentially really, really broad. So there's an available religious exemption in effect under federal civil rights law, but hospitals, and this has been quite revealing, having worked with workers in so many states this fall, I really had a unique insight, a cross-section of what's going on around the country, if you will. And the vast majority of the hospitals were violating federal law with their religious exemption policies. And what I ended up doing with many of my clients, and in a few instances ultimately with the help of hospital attorneys when we can get them involved, is reforming policy, changing policy, because these policies need to be changed to bring them into compliance with federal law. So that's been happening all over the country. And I'm proud to say that I've had a hand in that in many different instances. But there have been a few hospitals that have just I said one hospital attorney out of probably something in the order of 200 clients I've worked with over the last couple of years. One hospital attorney actually made a brief, but in my opinion, highly flawed legal argument trying to say that my client didn't qualify, but he honestly just seemed to not know what he was talking about. The vast majority of hospitals have, and hospital attorneys have agreed with me and cooperated with me. But it's really when the hospitals don't respond favorably to the law, and this happens in a minority of cases, it's the administrators who are trying to find a way to exclude any and all exemptions. I don't have any information, any objective information at this point documenting that there are any sort of kickbacks involved, but there certainly is money involved on the Medicare and Medicaid level, and very likely other kinds of financial incentives for hospital administrators, directly or indirectly, to
right.
maximize immunization rates.
Right. Really, this is really something. And is it similar in the school system where as long as a certain percentage of students are going to class, they get federal funding, but when the days when there's not enough students, they don't have the same funding? Am I on the right track here, or is that not right?
I don't recall the specifics, but I do recall hearing something similar to what you're saying. What it boiled down to was that there could be money involved for the schools based on money awarded or withheld based on immunization rates. I don't have any details right off the cuff on that, but that's certainly a point worth looking into. You know, there's really two ways.
Not only immunization rates, but attendance rates. Is that correct?
I don't have specific information on that off the cuff.
Oh, okay.
We won't be a point worth looking up.
Okay.
But there's a sort of a general underlying principle here, and that's that there's two ways, very effective ways, to control people in our current culture and society, and that is money and fear. And you control the hospital administrators by implementing a rule that says, in effect, doesn't matter whether the policy makes sense or not, you have to vaccinate everybody or you're going to, you know, lose money. And
uh-huh.
So they're not going to try to debate with Medicare and Medicaid the virtues or lack thereof of the flu exemption policy. The CDC and other health authorities support this, but that's not because of an objective view of the medical literature and the medical science. That's because of politicization, is that the word? Politicizing of the federal healthcare agencies and the influence of the pharmaceutical industry. Because, of course, by mandating the flu shot in healthcare workers, the first thing you do is double or triple sales in that market. But they're doing this in a very deliberate, now this is not speculation on my part, I've read this, you know, federal web pages. The purpose is of starting with healthcare workers is then to use that as a model for the rest of the country, because there's a specific federal objective to vaccinate all employees with the flu shot. So they're going first for all the healthcare workers, and then that'll be the springboard for convincing everyone else in the country that they should get the flu shot, or all the other employers that they should be requiring the flu shot.
And then they can slowly add more vaccines for other things.
I imagine. Of course. There in 2010 there were over 330 vaccines on the market or in development. There's always going to be another vaccine to give someone, and there will always be another person to give a vaccine. And so there's just no light at the end of the tunnel. And if you have concerns now about the adverse effects of vaccines, prepare for those concerns to just continue to increase, because I just don't see any end into this in terms of the agenda. Now, there are things that we can do to respond to this, and there are certainly areas to explore in terms of what response and what kind of response needs to be implemented in order to derail this train or turn it around and make it go the other direction, because it's definitely going the wrong way here.
Right. It's
very, very serious problems.
Well, I have also posted along with this announcement a recent video, an interview on the Mercola.com website with Dr. Pilevsky. And he is a renowned and highly respected pediatrician. I'm sure you know who he is. And he has become a holistic physician. And his words, you know, we really need to listen to during an age when pediatricians really are dismissing and not taking families, not taking children into their practice if the family has a different belief system and non-vaccination. Dr. Pilevsky says he, over the years, has listened to what the parents of his patients have been telling him. And instead of putting a blind eye to it and saying, oh, it's just coincidence, he started investigating. What is the connection between all of these parents who tell them that their kids are getting ill and not behaving, and behavioral problems and other kinds of digestive problems, and this occurs after the vaccination? So that's why he has been going around the country speaking and has changed the way he does his practice. And it's a really wonderful video interview. It's on the Dr. Mercola website. And I don't know whether you got a chance to see that or not.
Haven't seen that, but I have met and spoken with Dr. Pilevsky. He's a wonderful guy. Quite unusual, and I mean this in the most admirable way possible, that what is it about him that distinguishes him from so many other pediatricians? What is it that enabled him to look into something for himself? You know, it's really interesting.
Good question.
When we're talking.
That's a really good question. I mean, you have to be an independent thinker. And I think he answers it when he says, I have to look at the science. And he started to investigate the science. It's changing your belief system and not trying to defend your position, because he said he's spoken to other physicians in large venues. And when he starts to put this stuff up, they get all huffy and, you know, their position is threatened of what they've always been doing. You know, it means that all of the years that they've been giving vaccinations, they've been harming their patients. Think about the guilt trip that they might get if they actually admitted that they were doing something wrong.
Doing something wrong, that they had been duped by the people they should be able to trust, but ultimately it turns out you can't. It's a very disturbing sort of thing, but I'm not even sure it's that. I just think there's this arrogance, and I don't know if it's because of the kind of people that the profession attracts. I suspect it's not so much that as it is the conditioning they receive in medical school, that they're superior to everybody else, that they know it, they don't have to listen to anybody else because nobody else knows that they're the expert. And that sort of mentality is quite common among medical doctors. It's quite disturbing. We see it in some other professions as well, but my personal impression is that it's more prevalent in the medical community than in any other profession. I've certainly seen it in the legal profession, but just not in the same way, not the same level of consistency and not the same degree. But there's a lot of interesting information in the news recently about the flu shot. Let's talk about just a couple of those points.
Okay.
I'm happy to move on to anything else we have to talk to today. Here's a couple of articles that were posted at therefusers.com. One posted right after Christmas. Nurse admitted to her own intensive care unit after flu vaccine adverse reaction. The nurse wanted to refuse the flu shot because she had asthma and a history of adverse reactions to the flu vaccine. Ultimately, she gave in and got the shot and ended up in intensive care with a life-threatening adverse reaction. She happens to be, according to this article, the co-president of the National Nurses United, the nation's largest nurses union. So that's kind of interesting.
Very interesting. So it's like within the system this is happening.
Oh, absolutely. And I hear this, you know, on a fairly regular basis from a small percentage of my healthcare worker clients. They will tell me, well, first of all, a percentage of my clients have had some sort of adverse flu reaction, and the hospitals are increasingly revising medical exemptions to be more and more difficult to get. And the policy that hospitals all seem to be moving to is that you have to have either had an anaphylactic shock reaction from a prior vaccine, mm-hmm. or Guillain, I don't know how you pronounce this.
Guillain-Barré
syndrome.
Yeah, it is hard to pronounce.
I just need to write it down somewhere. I keep forgetting it. The Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks of a vaccine. And there are many, many other perfectly legitimate reasons, medical reasons, to not get a flu vaccine. I had one nurse who had letters from three different doctors, and the hospital still said, no, you have to get the shot. They're just being really absurd about this.
How could they possibly put their staff at risk of having an adverse effect that could threaten their life?
Well, for one thing, there's no monetary risk to them for doing that. If somebody has an adverse reaction, they have to go to the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program.
Right.
So the hospital doesn't, you know, it's not a workman's comp case. At least that's my understanding. It's not a potential workman's comp case. The federal law probably would usurp that, supersede that, and so they would have to go to the injury compensation program. And for another reason, there's obviously money involved, or they wouldn't be concerned about it one way or the other, because clearly it's not a health issue. And let me elaborate just briefly on that. There are many potential explanations as to why it's not a health issue, but I'll give you just one little piece of it. The Lancet published a study a little over a year ago showing that, or claiming that, flu vaccines were 60% effective. Now, it turns out that particular figure was a misrepresentation of the data in favor of the vaccine. But let's take it at face value. Let's assume that it means what it says, that 40% of people who get the flu vaccine are not going to be protected. Now, that's in a year when they match the strains. They develop the flu vaccines, you know, 1 year at a time, but several months in advance, and they have to guess which of the many different flu strains are going to be the dominant strains. And according to the Cochrane Collaboration, there's over 200 viruses that can cause flu-like symptoms. And so, you know, to be able to pick which ones are going to be dominant any given year in advance is a lot of guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they use statistical projections and other ways of trying to address it. But the bottom line is, that, at least according to one source, the accuracy there is not particularly high. But let's assume they get it right, and 40% then, according to The Lancet anyway, are not protected. Well, if it was really a serious health issue, then hospitals would have to test everyone, at least all of their employees who work with the immunocompromised patients, because those are the ones at greatest risk. And there's not any hospital anywhere in the U.S. that I've ever heard of that's testing anyone. And the flip side of this, you can get natural immunity without getting a vaccine. You may already be immune to this year's dominant flu strain or strains, And according to the CDC, you can get immunity without even developing symptoms. You don't even necessarily have to get sick to develop immunity, which is fascinating. So the bottom line is you can't tell if somebody is immune by their vaccination status. Vaccines don't work in everyone, and some people who aren't vaccinated are already immune. But they treat vaccination like if you're vaccinated, you're protected, and if you're not vaccinated, you're going to kill everybody.
Right.
And it just doesn't work that way. And this is astounding to me when I think about it, because it's a simple principle, but it's one that the vast majority of medical doctors, at least in my experience and what I hear from others,
It tries to put it into a black and white issue to its most simplistic form without understanding the complexity and not taking go ahead.
The issue here is that vaccination status is an issue for groups. It's not an issue immune status is not an issue about individuals. It's an issue about groups.
Uh-huh.
Because not everyone vaccinated is going to be immune, but you don't have to have everyone be immune. As long as most people in a community are immune, you've got the herd immunity protection. At least that's the prevailing mainstream theory. But
You could have the herd immunity by taking care of yourself. By if the population all went out and ran and did exercise and got the sun and did all those good things that we constantly tell people to do and nourish themselves with vitamin C and vitamin D and all these great stuff, we would be building herd immunity, would we not?
Well, herd immunity, as I understand it, has to do with occurs when a large enough percentage of a population has the antibodies to any particular disease. And then the theory is that as long as most people have the antibodies, then the disease is no longer able to spread among or throughout the community.
Okay. So it's not just how well you take care of yourself, because contagious infectious disease can affect people, just like coming in with smallpox from the colonialists coming in and wiping out an entire nation of Indians, native population, because they did not have any natural immunity to this type of a disease. So strength coming. I mean, that's like an example. I'm going to bring in another point, though, and that is through all of the vaccinations, we are making the strains of influenza and other infectious diseases stronger and more resistant to any vaccination or any antibiotics and any other kind of Western medicine that we have. And if you listen to the last Monday show, the Health In show with Dr. Bruck, on this type of mutating resistance, then you can learn a little bit more about how we're really pushing the diseases to become resistant to everything.
However unintentionally or not that may be, but it does certainly appear to be what's happening, and that's rather disturbing, and it suggests that the entire model we're using to address this, and here I'm referring to allopathy as opposed to homeopathy and naturopathy and chiropractic and acupuncture and all the other systems out there that are available, to me it raises a question about the entire model, the approach. I mean, the basic concept of vaccination, if you look at it superficially, sounds, plausible, that you're trying to create antibodies with a weakened virus that will still nonetheless protect against bacteria from the wild virus or bacteria. But there are so many flaws when you look at it at a deeper level that it really is questionable. And ultimately the reality check here is, well, what's happening in the world? Is it working or not? And there's certainly lots of people and sources to say that it's worked fine, shut up, go away, go talk about something else. But I have been looking at the issue since my 19-year-old was born, and I find that the deeper I dig, the messier it gets. I do not I find substantial evidence to support the proposition that vaccine policy and law is a political phenomenon, not something driven by health. And I see the ongoing changes in policy and law that move so far, moving us more and more in favor of more vaccines and fewer rights to refuse them, as moving in the direction of increasing profits for the pharmaceutical industry. It's an enormously profitable industry. The projected sales in 2012 internationally were $38.8 billion, according to one source, and that's supposed to be increasing by 10 or 11% each year for the next several years. There's huge financial incentive to deny, cover up, or otherwise obscure any information that would raise questions about immunizations. And it's not just the profits from the immunizations themselves. That's just the beginning, because by aggressively immunizing more and more people, you're creating more and more widespread and severe chronic diseases that then most people will treat with further medical treatments, again, increasing pharmaceutical profits even farther. So it's an insidious system that we're living under right now, frankly.
That sounds very strange to my ears, to say that we're producing these immunizations. We tell the people this is going to protect you from a virulent disease that could cause you death, and it spreads very rapidly through communities, and you have to take such good care and get your immunizations. And underlying that is a knowledge that it's really causing for the short term, they're saying, okay, we're going to help you through this acute illness, but for the long term, you're going to end up with fibromyalgia or bowel chronic discomforts and colitis and other kinds of diseases and neurological diseases, behavioral diseases, the heavy metals and all the ingredients that we've discussed cause violence in behavior and unstable emotions. And from this, we can provide you more salvos of more drugs that you have to take for the rest of your life. It's truly bizarre. It's hard for me to fathom that anyone would think this way.
Well, and me as well, and I think that's part of the reason why it's so difficult for us as a society to come to terms with this, to recognize what's really going on, let alone to take further steps to actually do something about it, because most of us, this is outside of the scope of something that would ever be a consideration. But the evidence keeps showing up. Forgive me for being redundant, because I know I've talked about this on past shows, but just a real quick example that comes to mind, that the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs, a nonprofit organization, in 2011, got a hold of emails through the Federal Freedom of Information Act, CDC emails, showing that they knew that when they took the mercury out of vaccines, they had study data showing when they took the mercury out of vaccines, the autism rates went down. And they deliberately, they were discussing whether or not to publish that data and chose not to publish the data. And the study that did get published is one that has been referred to over and over again as proof that vaccines don't cause autism. And so we have mainstream media officials and health officials all saying the vaccine autism case is closed. Vaccines don't cause autism, while there are other studies out there showing that it does cause autism. So that's just an example. So, you know, it's the pretense of objective science coming from the medical literature and the state and federal health authorities is exactly that. It's a pretext. Now, I don't know which
make a note here? What you're just saying is another, method or strategic way to put out information, and it's so much harder to retract or get the public or scientists or anybody to think differently once a statement is put out in a medical journal, in a authoritarian piece of literature, to say that, you know, mercury and autism, there's no tie to that, there's no link and there's no causation. And then to have to, any kind of retraction, when the New York Times puts out a piece of news and then they, in a little tiny place, they say, this picture was mislabeled. This person's name doesn't belong here. Whoever sees that, who pays attention to it, and that the old information is constantly repeated again and again. And so it's never really fully recovered. Do you understand what I'm saying here?
It's hard to unring a bell, I think, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
As the figure of speech goes. Although we see this happening more and more, there's an increasing number of studies over recent years that have been retracted as being false or in some cases fraudulent. It's a phenomenon that's increasing. For whatever reason, maybe it started as a really minor infringement, but it's a slippery slope kind of phenomenon. You know, once you cross a line don't get called on it, you go, oh, I can do that, you know, and then, you know, the pressure is there. The competition for people to move up in the medical industry is pretty fierce, and the competition of the medical industry to take full advantage of anything and everything it can to maximize profits, people get very myopic in their thinking, in their actions, in their behavior, and denial kicks in, so they just immediately reject anything that is opposing. I mean, I'm trying to give these people the benefit of the doubt, and many of them, I'm sure, don't deserve it. And I'm sure there are many people in the profession who honestly believe what they've been told and taught, and they're sincere, credible people with integrity. So it's certainly not a slam against everybody with a medical degree, but many people in the profession, and it seems the majority at this point, do buy what they've been taught and told and turn around and spout that as the quote-unquote expert who happens to be gifted at memorizing and regurgitating information.
Oh, boy.
which is a talent. Don't get me wrong. That is a talent, but there's a very different talent and much less common talent and much more valuable and talent, which is being able to process and analyze and critically assess the information that you're being handed. And it takes some moral character and strength to do that from someone who is, in some sense, your superior or authority. And in this sense, I'm referring to federal and state health agencies and experts and so forth. When those people,
it would take a lot of energy and effort away from your day-to-day functioning and living and practice to have to start a battle against such a large entity. That would be, you know, oh my gosh, looking at this huge thing in front of you, how could you ever, as one small person, make a difference or stand up to what you say, the strength, your moral strength against your superior authority, the federal and state agencies. That is a huge battle that most people are not willing to take on.
Well, most people aren't even willing to consider a question that has the potential to lead to that question. Do I take on the battle? In other words, they're not even going to – I don't even think most people get to the place where they're saying, that's not a battle I'm willing to take on. I don't even think they allow themselves to get to that point. But we've got to get to that point with people in and out of the medical community. And I also see that happening. You know, I had a Fox News journalist interviewed me yesterday and was – asking me where I see all this going or something to that effect. And it was a really interesting question because I see progress on two opposing sides, and I'm not sure what the result of that is going to be or when. But on the one hand, the pro-vaccine agenda is moving rapidly forward on multiple fronts, healthcare workers is one of them. Changing state laws for school exemptions is another level. There are grants in Obamacare available to states who get on board with pro-vaccine agenda and activities. There's just many, many different levels where this is playing out. And if nothing happens to stop these different parts to the agenda, for those of us who are concerned about vaccines, the future for us is increasingly darker. That's what we have to look forward to. It's not, I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but I can tell you it's not a pretty picture. On the other hand, I see a growing number of people investigating the issue, looking into this for themselves, which is a difficult thing for most people to do. So I really have to commend anyone and everyone who is willing to say, despite what the authorities are saying, I'm still going to look at this and see if there's information to me that sounds credible that has a different conclusion or a different point of view. So the people
I think it's based on experience. It's based on somebody in their family. And just like the figure of cancer, breast cancer, it used to be 1 in 20, 1 in 8. It's now 1 in 5. It's touching the lives of people. So the fact that these adverse effects of vaccines are touching the lives of people and really changing the entire family dynamic, that they cannot not look at it. There's no way. It's in your face. And so when you know a neighbor, when you know somebody in your church, when you know somebody in your school that's dealing with these issues, that's when, you know, it's making an effect.
Well, the trigger is different for everyone, and I think it has to do with personality types or personality factors. But, you know, some people will not have to have a close tragedy to be prompted to investigate and learn about it. Other people can have a huge tragedy. I mean, there are people with kids who developed autism after getting vaccines who say, who firmly believe the vaccine had nothing to do with their autism, kid child's autism. It's you know, some people can get the cosmic 2x4 over the head and they still don't wake up. So it's everybody's different. But I do see a broader and increasing rate and level of awareness in society as a whole. I mean, I see more and more people coming to me, for one thing, asking information about exemptions, and I think that's an indication, at least on one level. More and more people are listening to shows like this, more information out there. And part of the indication of concern about the truth getting out from folks on the other side is that they're now resorting to some really immature, and have been, but increasingly so, really immature tactics, attack tactics. I've been reportedly accused by one hospital administrator of being, I don't remember the exact language, something to the effect of being a bogus attorney. Not that I wasn't an attorney, but that I've never won a case was one of the phrases used, which I find highly amusing because I have a consulting practice. I don't even go to court, so I don't even have cases at all. So, and when I did go to court, I won some and lost some. That's what happens, you know, with any typical legal professional. But, I mean, it's just totally absurd. But the comment was, all you got to do is go look this guy up on the Internet. You know, go Google him and you'll see what a, you know, an idiot he is or whatever. Well, you know, people who are pro-vaccine and feel threatened by my work to help people and who are also, I think immature is probably the best word for it,
let me add this other little note. It's the use of the language that I find, I don't know what the word is. Maybe you can help me out. But I was reading this article about the influenza, the high rate of influenza in North Carolina this season. They say it is the worst flu season in decades. I have not been able to look at the statistics to know that for sure. But they basically said influenza death is killing people. You know, and if they don't say when I hear the word killed, I think of somebody being murdered and stabbed and a shooting or something, rather than a person succumbs and dies of an illness. Typically, it is a secondary illness, not the flu, but to say 14 people across the state have been killed. Now, what do you think about that?
Well, that's a really interesting point. That's a subtle, but I think very deliberate word choice there. And I think it's I agree with you. I think that is a misuse of the word. People aren't killed by the flu. People die from the flu if they indeed do die from the flu.
Yeah.
But as you point out, they don't usually die from the flu.
So it's
not. I mean, there's no 100% safe way to live your life. You know, inherent in daily life is risk at every moment. So it's not like get the shot and you're safe or don't get the shot and you're safe. People have to make choices, but there are certainly, and the flu vaccine, of all the diseases that there are vaccines for, the flu is the one I am least worried about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really interesting to me that it's being made such a big thing out of. And I think the reason for that is because it's an annual vaccine, huge financial incentive to focus your attention if you're a vaccine manufacturer on a vaccine that you get to make and distribute and have people get every year. So, again, It just because something is financially advantageous to the pharmaceutical industry doesn't mean automatically it's wrong or bad, but it certainly is given how this industry operates. It's certainly something to take into consideration. When you see something coming out of the CDC saying a recommendation that necessarily will increase pharmaceutical profits, then you need to take a close look at that and say, okay, is this about the profits or, is there really anything health related here or is it really just about the profits? Because this is an industry that, as I've said in the past, routinely engages in criminal behavior, and this is documented in the many instances in which pharmaceutical industries every year are fined, sometimes as much as I think the highest fine I've seen so far is $3 billion. There have been at least three fines that were over $1 billion, combination of criminal and civil fines, and criminal fines as high as $1 billion or more dollars, $1 billion with a B. And criminal fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars are common. So, I mean, again, this is an industry that should not be dictating policy, but in fact it is. And whatever we would do or not do or would expect other people to do or not do, most of us aren't criminals, and so we don't think the way that criminals do. But this is an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior. They have a different way of thinking. They have a different way of operating. And we need to recognize, whether we like it or not, that there are human beings on the planet, some of them with advanced degrees and in powerful positions in government and industry, who can think in ways that we would never think and act on that as well.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of frightening. And the way that you're talking about this criminality, the use of the word, let me find it for you, in the same article from the North Carolina flu, it's in the News and Observer, our local paper here, that the signs of the season may be leveling off and come from a number of new cases reporting in a statewide, and this is what bothers me, a surveillance network of emergency rooms and doctor's offices. And again, the use of the word 14 people have been killed and now we have a surveillance. I do find that, I don't know if it's a mafia, but it's kind of scary, the use of the words of Big Brother doing this kind of work, as opposed to information is being collected, incoming data from the hospitals have been gathered. I mean, it's a much softer way to speak. Somehow the vocabulary seems to be loaded with innuendo and connotations of war and subversion. Maybe it goes along with all the fines that the pharmaceutical companies are receiving.
Well, there are a growing number of people who over recent years have been trying to warn the public that we as a society and culture are evolving in a direction that is moving towards a police state. And there have been some who have looked at societies historically. And here are a list of conditions that precede a police state. And I know at least one article listed 10 different things, and we had already gone through 9 of those steps. It's quite frightening, because it's like the old, thing about a frog in boiling water, where
yeah.
you turn the water up quickly, the frog jumps out. If you turn the water, the heat up slowly, the frog will just stay in there until he's cooked. And the water has been being turned up slowly over recent decades, but more rapidly, I think, in very recent years and months. And we as the American society still haven't recognized that we need to jump out of the pot yet. Although many of us, a minority of us, are becoming increasingly clear about that. So it's going to be interesting.
Do you think that more people are leaving the country? I don't have any statistics on that. I'm just curious.
I don't have any statistics. I certainly know anecdotally, I know people who have moved out of the country because they, for them, they see the writing on the wall that it's inevitable that there's going to be some sort of breakdown or rapid and critical and substantial shift in the structure and function of our society here, either economic collapse or any number of different events or combination of events, natural or man-made, or potentially, could happen. And who knows if, any one or more of them will actually manifest or take place. But there are people who have left the country specifically for that. Dr. Remo LeBeau of Natural Solutions is one example. Is another
right.
guy, I don't recall his name off the top of my head, but who provides a lot of alternative health information, who does this now from somewhere in Central or South America. And a lot of people are...
I think that the people in the natural health fields... Yeah, the people in the natural health fields who feel that their rights are threatened, that they're not going to be able to practice the way that they prefer based on their political beliefs, their personal and religious belief about health and their medical conditions, they will find a way to continue. If it's not here, it will be somewhere else where they will be allowed to practice. And they're trying to bring people with them. They're trying to form small communities, communes, or little societies of people who can have skills to do that. It is a changing world. So did we have, more information about this particular issue?
Well, let me make a real quick mention of a couple other things here. There's an article that's on a website called experimentalvaccines.org. 160,000 flu shots were recalled. Switzerland and Italy banned some Novartis flu vaccines. And the recall was due to particles seen floating in the vials, which were later determined to be protein aggregates.
Mm-hmm.
This is really interesting because, according to this article, this kind and the aggregates are misfolded proteins, and they're toxic, and they're linked to diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, 160,000 doses were so saturated with protein aggregates that it was visible to the naked eye as floating particulate matter.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting and as disturbing as it is interesting.
And why is it interesting? As
well,
more,
I just,
more than disturbing.
I just had not heard of this particular issue, but according to this article, it's something that's common, that this protein aggregation.
Is
and
this older? When was this produced? I'm trying to think of when we had this information. I feel as if, it's just posted December 20th, 2012.
Yeah, it's a very, very recent article.
Uh-huh.
They're saying these particular flu shots have the highest level of mercury allowed, which is double the amount found in other vaccines.
Uh-huh.
They said that the manufacturer says that protein aggregation is common in vaccine production.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads this particular writer, who has a very strong anti-vaccine point of view, to say that we can only assume this is standard operating procedure created as a design rather than a design aspect rather than a design flaw. But if protein aggregation is common, then this is more evidence for the concern that vaccines are related to, in this instance, this particular neurological chronic diseases or conditions. So,
mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Something is beeping on my side, I'm sorry. And I'm not sure about how I'm going to be able to figure out how to stop that. So.
Not hearing it on this end, so hopefully.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Just with you. But here's another one just for fun. Oral vaccines for farmed fish under development. So you can vaccinate fish now. They've got a great picture with this. They actually show somebody wearing gloves, holding a fish in one hand and injecting it
uh-huh.
with a vaccine with a large needle in the other hand. And is this what
really
comes
to? And why are they vaccinating fish?
Oh, to keep them well so that they'll have...
Are these fish that we eat?
Yes, farmed fish.
These are farmed fish, so now we're going to get a vaccine in our fish. This
yes.
is why I
yes.
never buy farmed fish, just because of the waters that they are in are polluted with antibiotics and other poop, you know, things that are going on that they're not. It's just like farming of any kind of animal. I know that there are some organic fish farms that do take a little bit better care, but I'm still concerned that it's not the natural habitat of the fish, and it's the health of the fish is not exactly the same. The meat and the fat of the fish is not exactly the same, and we want to eat the fat of fish because that's where all of the omega-3 and other good stuff is found for our health. And yet, if fat accumulates toxins, that would make me concerned. Because usually the farmed fish is really nice and fatty. It's delicious, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, here's the short answer. It says, researchers explain that increasing density of fish in farms, the increased density of fish in farms, causes a higher concentration of pathogens, and with them, the appearance of diseases in fish.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, the same thing you see in land production of land farm animals, that if you have an increased number of animals in a small space, you have increased diseases, and that's why they end up having to give them antibiotics and other things to try and combat all of that.
It goes to humans, too. If you put too many people in a small quarter, you're going to have more disease and more infection. And no matter what living organism, if there are too many in a small amount of space and there's not enough food, nutrition, air, clean air and water to keep them alive, then I can see fish suffocating if there's not enough oxygen bubbling through that water. So,
I bet there's a physical and emotional stress component, certainly with humans and perhaps animals as well. With the close quarters or the captivity in cages and things like that. But in any event, regardless of the type of stress or stresses involved, the large number of animals in a small area has stressors associated with it that contribute, I'm sure, to health problems, increase of disease, and so forth. But you know, they're all looking at it from the money point of view. How can you get the most product for the least amount of money? And so they want to grow more fish in a smaller area. And, well, if that means more disease, then they're going to vaccinate the fish. If they can still come out with a net profit by growing, you know, raising more fish in a smaller, in the same amount of space, then they'll do it. And we need to change our way of thinking. Ultimately, I think it may mean revising our entire societal structure to remove capitalism altogether. I don't have the answer, but capitalism, because of human nature, capitalism breeds manipulation and deceit and harm to people. Yes, it probably has some positive attributes as well, but I don't think it's a problem you can fix by just passing another law, because as we see with the pharmaceutical industry, for example, that just is, you know, for them, criminal laws are not a barrier, it's a financial consideration. They pay the fine, they pay their $3 billion fine, they made $23 billion doing what breaking the law, and they came out $20 billion ahead. It's not a disincentive to criminalize something. It's a veneer. Mm-hmm. It's not addressing the problem. And I don't think you can ultimately solve these problems by just changing laws or prosecuting people. Not that we shouldn't change laws. We should, and we should be prosecuting anyone and everyone who breaks laws, and anyone who knowingly deceives the public with the result of injury or death, which has occurred by people in the CDC, in and out of the CDC, as has been documented, these people should be punished accordingly.
Yes.
So far, it's not happening.
Well, the whole system will definitely have to be restructured in some way. I don't know how or when it can occur in a two-party system the way that we have it today, because people who don't fit into that system are put by the wayside, as we've seen in the last major election, presidential election, that the people who were not Democratic or Republican candidates were not heard in the mainstream media. And so if you are a minority and have a smaller voice, if you're in the Green Party, or if you have a differing opinion, you may not get heard. And that is a problem, because diversity breeds health in all aspects of life, every kind of organism. Diversity is the key to health. So that's kind of where I'm going to end today.
I agree with you on that point.
Yeah. We've been talking for an hour, and also I'm going to continue to talk on my own if you're not going to sit in with me. I know you probably have a pile of stuff on your desk to take care of.
I do.
Yeah, and we can just let people know that they can contact you at pandemicresponseproject.com, or where else will they contact you? They could get your e-guide to get themselves off the ground and started in their educational journey.
Right, and all the contact information is available at vaccinerights.com.
Vaccinerights.com. That's the place to find Alan Phillips, who's he's the man, he's working for us, whether you know it or not, just by the little steps that he takes. Getting on all different, you're on a lot of different radio shows, answering questions from reporters and doing lectures. You are happy to do a talk someplace for anybody who needs a speaker.
I am.
Of different things. And dealing with the legislative action. So we appreciate that. Okay.
Well, thank you too, Debbie. I will see you next week.
I will see you next week, Alan, and I'm going to keep talking as he goes off the air. I'm going to be talking about our study of The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD. On to Chapter 11. Yesterday, Wednesday, I talked about the law of cure, and today is the chief complaint and the auxiliary symptoms in their relation to the case. So the chief complaint, CC, is what a person usually walks into the office and wants to say, they get migraines or they have back pain in chronic conditions, or they have a sprain and they can't walk in an acute condition. So what would Dr. Herbert Roberts teach the physician or teach the medical student? And that's really what this talk is. It's a study session, just like all of the talks that we have on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. It's educational broadcasting, informational. We're not prescribing. We're not diagnosing. We are just providing information for the listener. So Dr. Roberts says, almost every case that comes to the attention of the physician presents two distinct phases, two separate parts, as it were. The part comprising the symptoms of which the patient complains, those which are most annoying to him and most outstanding in his recognition, and secondly, those symptoms which he does not recognize as symptoms, or which he does not consider worth reporting, or does not consider as having any relationship to the case. So you see those two parts, one which is in the person's consciousness, which is at uppermost in hand, their most discomfort and pain, and those other things that they've gotten so used to that they don't even think it's part of their illness anymore, or they dismiss it and find a rationalization to say, this isn't part of the same deal that I'm going through. Dr. Roberts says, the chief complaint has a psychological value out of all proportion to its value in homeopathic prescribing. It brings the patient to the physician, and if the physician responds and by careful questioning draws out the history of other symptoms, the patient feels a satisfaction and confidence that the physician is not treating his case as of no consequence. So he doesn't just say, oh, you get migraines, that's okay. This is the time in your life when all women get migraines. Or it's just psychosomatic, or you're just overreacting, or this is just something that you have to live with. It's not brushed away by a true physician, by a homeopathically trained physician who is understanding that it is the psychological component that is so large in the person's life that brings him to the doctor's office in the first place. In other words, the person needs help, and that's why they go walk and make an appointment to see the doctor. Now, the chief complaint, he says, is a very necessary part of every case. Some of our colleges are giving the chief complaint of every case much consideration. The young physician places much dependence upon this part of the case. It is close to his training along diagnostic lines. The old prescriber, while giving due weight to the chief symptoms, feels that in prescribing he must consider the totality of the symptoms, and in order to do so, he must give more weight to the other part, probably unexpressed, without some encouragement on the part of the physician, which is an even more necessary part of the case than the chief complaint, because it is that part which manifests more clearly the individuality of the patient and indicates most clearly the individuality of the remedy to cover the case, the totality of symptoms, if you prefer. So here he's saying, sure, you can walk into the doctor, you can say that you have a migraine, you have a headache, you have the basic things that are ticked off as the list of symptoms for a diagnosed or labeled disease. And is that going to give you the answer to the similimum, the homeopathic, well-matched pattern of symptoms that that person actually has to the drug, the medicine, which was all discussed in yesterday's show? What are the symptoms that a drug elicits that pattern? So you have to have that overlapping pattern. The chief complaint, as presented by the patient, may be altogether different in value from the symptoms discovered and illuminated by the physician's analysis of the case. The chief complaint is often a pathological state or an approach toward a pathological state in the functional sphere. So he's saying here, the chief complaint, talking about a change in the tissue structure, the pathology, that something has changed, and we usually like to get something at a functional level that has not totally changed the way the body is maintaining stasis. So he says, the chief complaint or the leading symptoms may be defined as those symptoms for which there is clear pathological foundation. Okay, so that explains how somebody can do a tissue swab, how somebody can take a blood pressure, how somebody can do an x-ray and see the pathologic clinical diagnostic changes in the lab, or the symptoms that are most prominent and clearly recognizable, or the symptoms which first attract the attention of the patient or physician, or which cause the most suffering, or which indicate definitely the seat and nature of the morbid process, which form the warp, quote, in parentheses, or taken out of warp of the fabric as it has been expressed. The auxiliary or concomitant symptom or group of symptoms seldom has any definite relationship to the leading symptoms from the standpoint of theoretical pathology. So on the one hand, you're looking at the lab reports, and at the other hand, you're looking at these concomitant symptoms, which he brings up a lot, these symptoms, auxiliary symptoms or group of symptoms that has a relationship to the individual. These are the symptoms which the pathologist would exclude as accidental and meaningless, but they have actually a definite relationship to the case because they occur in the same patient and at the same time or in definite relationship of time as the other symptoms which are considered the chief complaint. So concomitant means that you've got a couple of things happening at one time. You have the pathological changes, the tissue changes, the organ changes, the psychological consideration of the patient who says, man, I can't handle this anymore, I got to go call the doctor because it's not making life pleasant for me and I can't function anymore. And then there are all of these other things, these concomitants, which don't seem to fit in with the chief complaint unless you understand them. If they do not fit into the theories of pathology, they have an even greater individual value in the case. Those symptoms which can be explained are of little help, says Dr. Roberts, in selecting the homeopathic remedy, but it is this group of auxiliary or concomitant symptoms which limit the choice of the similimum. So here, if we learn the individuality of the case, these concomitant symptoms, you're going to be heading in the direction of finding the similimum, the matching remedy homeopathically. That group of which the patient complains most, almost without exception, cannot be relied upon for the definite selection of the remedy. It is the concomitant group of symptoms which, taken in conjunction with the major group of symptoms, makes possible the definite selection of the remedy by greatly reducing the number of remedies indicated in such conditions. And upon a closer analysis, we can pick the similimum unerringly from this small group. So you start with the broad, the most broad of common symptoms, and you bring into that circle the individual more narrow concomitant symptoms that are occurring at the same time as the most common symptoms, and you reduce the number of medicines that are available to cover that group, both the larger group of symptoms and the smaller group of symptoms. For instance, when we find a case where the patient gives as her chief complaint ovarian pain, we cannot instantly pick the remedy from a consideration of this symptom alone. The homeopathic Materia Medica has over 50 remedies that have the symptom, chief complaint, ovarian pain. Cerebral congestion may be met with any one of 150 or more remedies, and so with many single remedy pictures. We might cite numerous complaints where the chief complaint would lead us into a morass of remedies, any one of which might give relief to the patient, but only one of which would cure. So says Dr. Roberts. And this is why studying the Materia Medica and all the remedies and all the symptom pictures and how they relate to the different organs and the mental and emotional condition of the patient helps you to learn more about the remedies that will match a particular individual. At times, the chief complaint seems contradictory to the auxiliary group of symptoms brought out by the physician's questioning. The patient may have, within the course of a day, an exceedingly dry mouth and then complain of his excessive moisture. The patient may complain of diarrhea, but a careful taking of the case may reveal an alternation of diarrhea and constipation, or there may be a complete alteration of different symptoms at different seasons of the year, as rheumatic conditions at one time and gastric disturbances at another time, rheumatic pains in the limbs during one attack, and perhaps rheumatic iritis at another time. The physician will find many such alternating symptom groups, any one of which may be the chief complaint. Only the thoughtless physician will tell the patient that the present symptom group is the one to be considered at the present time. And when the other symptom group appears, it will be plenty of time to consider that group. Such an attitude on the part of the physician may seem logical, but the thoughtful student of homeopathy realizes that many remedies in our Materia Medica have alternating group symptoms, and he cannot ignore any symptoms which the patient may recite. Fascinating information, is it not, that you must take the entire case to understand the changes that the person may exhibit in different situations, in different seasons, in different weather conditions, in different stress conditions, because that will help to find the appropriate remedy that also has the same alternation and alteration of symptoms, that maybe diarrhea is not the only thing that you have to look at. You have to look at the constipation or the dryness or the wetness or whatever it is. Much has been said of keynote prescribing. Many of the present time, at the present time, use the repertory simply as a peculiar and unusual symptom. This has a certain value. If we are so fortunate as to find the similimum by some outstanding peculiar symptom, but most often, this is not enough, and it has little more value than selecting at random any one remedy from a group known to have a certain symptom in the provings. We must not fail to recognize the value of the totality of the symptoms, and this must be taken into consideration, the chief complaints, those of which the patient most often complains, plus the peculiar characteristics of the patient. If both these elements are present, we may be sure we are on the right track. Let us consider a few cases. So here he's teaching us that we have to look at the beginning, we have to look at the phases, the parts of the chief complaint, and all of the parts that come under the secondary symptoms, those that the patient doesn't even recognize belong to the same problem. Let us consider a few cases. A young woman complains of tension, stiffness, and lameness through the muscles of her back, particularly between the shoulders and in the nape of the neck. the stiffness causing a pulling sensation of the muscles even into the cheeks. She cannot turn her head without distress, bending the body or raising the arms, especially the left, aggravates the condition. How many remedies and what remedies flash through your mind if you're a homeopath as possibly covering these symptoms? However, you feel the need of more careful questioning to elicit more characteristic symptoms for this symptom group, although it is the chief complaint and is not enough on which to base your prescription if you wish to be sure of curing your patient. So maybe he says, yes, you can find a remedy that will cover this tension, stiffness, lameness in the muscles of the back, in the shoulders, in the nape of the neck, causing a pulling sensation into the cheeks, problems raising the arm and bending, feeling distress and aggravation. There are a number of remedies, but you might give that remedy and take care of those problems, but you're still left with the disease if you haven't considered the totality of the case. It develops upon further inquiry that she also has a leukorrhea. This symptom also might come into a number of remedies that you have already hastily considered as applicable to the case, but in itself, it has no value as a differentiating symptom. Upon careful questioning, the patient volunteered that her leukorrhea comes on only when sitting. She's absolutely free from it as soon as she gets up on her feet, either standing or walking. Here is truly auxiliary symptom that has a unique value. Leukorrhea only when sitting. So far as I have been able to determine, says Dr. Roberts, there is only one remedy which in the proving has developed this characteristic symptom, and that is phagopyrum. Lest we be accused of keynote prescribing, let us look over the symptoms of this remedy in their relationship to the chief complaint. We find the muscular tension and drawing, especially between the shoulders and the nape. We find other symptoms of which the patient complained, less characteristic of any remedy in particular than those mentioned. And then we find the outstanding symptom, characteristic and peculiar, which is perhaps the most characteristic and peculiar symptoms of phagopyrum, the leukorrhea only while sitting. And we know beyond any question that we have found the similimum. In this case, the chief complaint was the tension of the muscles, the lameness, but the outstanding concomitant symptom that apparently bore no relationship at all to the chief complaint was the leukorrhea, better while standing or walking, worse when sitting. It was the symptom which, taken in conjunction with the other more common symptoms, defined the choice of remedy. A case of chronic asthma complains of the characteristic wheezing, suffocative sensation, and other symptoms which we call asthma. How can we prescribe on these symptoms? How many remedies have these symptoms? Of course, the answer is that the chief complaint here is of use merely as a background upon which to depict the individual peculiarities in the case. His cough is worse at night. He is better after expectoration. His hands and his feet are icy cold. These symptoms may limit the number of remedies that we consider, but still, there is nothing that definitely points the way to the selection of the remedy. He adds that he has an attack come on after he becomes angry, or the attack is worse after anger, or worse after eating. He is fearful, especially at night. Our search narrows still more. Then he adds the most enlightening sensation rising up from his stomach into his throat and suffocating him, which brings on the attack. There are but two remedies to be thought of with this symptom, sepia and Mancinella. The provings of Mancinella have brought out the symptom phrased by the provers exactly as the patient described it, while sepia has a close counterpart. A comparison of the two remedies in relationship to the totality of symptoms leaves us in no doubt but that the remedy is Mancinella. Boninghausen once offered a prize for a treatise concerning the greater or lesser characteristic value of the symptoms occurring in a disease to aid as a norm or basis in the therapeutical selection of the remedy. After 3 years of silence on the part of the homeopathic world, Boninghausen himself attempted to give
what he considered a somewhat adequate answer. His reply was founded on Hahnemann's instructions in paragraph 153 of the fifth edition of the Organon, or as Boninghausen puts it, this paragraph, quote, contains the proper, true kernel of the answer and deserves to be first premised, unquote. And so now he's quoting from the Organon, paragraph 153 of the fifth edition. Quote, it says, in seeking for the specific homeopathic remedy, for example, in this juxtaposition of the phenomena of the natural disease and the list of symptoms of the medicines, in order to discover a morbid potency corresponding in similitude to the evil to be cured, the more striking, peculiar, particular, unusual, and peculiar characteristic signs and symptoms of the case should be especially and almost solely kept in view. For there must especially be some symptoms in the list of the medicine sought for corresponding to this. If the remedy should be the one most suitable to the cure, the more general and indefinite symptoms such as lack of appetite, headache, weariness, disturbed sleep, uncomfortableness, etc., in their generalness and undefinedness deserve but little attention, unless they are more especially pronounced as something of a general nature is seen in almost every disease and in almost every medicine. After this quotation from the Organon, Boninghausen continues to say, it is seen, however, that it is here left to the physician to judge what is understood by the more striking, particular, unusual, and peculiar symptoms, and it might indeed be difficult to furnish a commentary to this definition, which would not be too diffuse and therefore easily understood, and on the other hand would be complete enough to be properly applied to all these cases. Unquote. It is obvious that Hahnemann never intended his directions to be taken that we do keynote prescribing, while his instructions were not to give undue weight to the most general of symptoms. It is to be remembered that Hahnemann never slighted any symptoms of a case in making a prescription. He had the genius of giving each symptom its true place in the picture without distorting the totality. While it is inconceivable that Hahnemann ever did keynote prescribing, it is also beyond our knowledge of Hahnemann's thorough mind that he eliminated the chief complaints in building up the symptom image. Our way, too, must lie in the golden mean between these two points, the one too general, the other too individual, to assure us of a true totality. If we can find a remedy that has the more striking, particular, unusual, and peculiar characteristic signs and symptoms of the case, and, in addition, covers the chief complaint as well, we may consider ourselves as having a sound basis for the prescription of the similimum. That ends Chapter 11. Of the Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Dr. Herbert Roberts, M.D. That was the chief complaint and the auxiliary symptoms in their relationship, in their relation to the case. And I hope that was enlightening and refreshing, and it helped to embed in your psyche how we look at the case, how we take the symptoms for a patient that, yes, we hear that they have a diagnosis, they have lab reports, they have pathology, they have clinical exams, but we also hear how they're feeling, what they're saying, how they respond to their environment in all different seasons and times, conditions and positions. What are the generals? What do they generally feel that might apply to them all over their body? If they have a type of sensation, whether it is a sticking pain, is that sticking pain in all different parts of their body, or is it in one localized part of their body? To if it's in all parts and it repeats again and again in many stressful situations, we could call it a general. Chapter 12 is going to be the dynamic action of drugs. That's going to be the next chapter we read. And
looking forward to this as we move along. There's 31 chapters to read, and we're doing this slowly at in between or after or before the other shows that we have on Wednesday with Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim talking about heart health. He will be back next week. And Alan Phillips talking about vaccines and your rights, all of the legal issues. He has become the national expert, in my mind, to exemptions and waivers and understanding the law dealing with vaccinations in not only his own state of North Carolina, but in the many states. He has become well-read and well-written. We also have the Health In Show, a lineup of shows coming up for the coming year. The banner will be on the front page of Homeopathy World Community. Look for it there. Visit us on Homeopathy World Community on Facebook and share, like, join, tweet, do everything you can to get more people to hear and learn about homeopathy, its potential for healing, for curative action, as stated by Dr. Herbert Roberts, if you find this a millimum. We appreciate all of you who tune in to the shows and share them. On Homeopathy World Community, I want to mention that we have a couple of items along the right-hand column right now. There is an ASEA water. It's a redox signaling molecule that more and more I'm reading the research about this type of stabilized water that can assist in healing or replenishing the body. We've got Dr. Dinesh Swan, who's been doing some new workshops beginning this month in January. Scylla Watcott is going to be back talking with us at the Health In Show later in this year. She has the solution. It's homeoprophylaxis, the vaccine alternative, and what her program is all about. Miranda Castro's discount code has ended for 2012, and we're beginning a new year. If you're interested in her books and the remedy kits that she has, as well as Homeopathy World kits and remedies, don't forget that the Complete Dynamics in Homeopathy is a complete computer program for people in the healthcare field, for people, whether you're a naturopath, a chiropractor, an acupuncturist, a homeopath, a student of homeopathy, a nurse, or a physician. The Complete Dynamics program is right there for you on your desktop, ready and available with the Materia Medica, the books of the drug pictures, and you can use the repertory to analyze the symptoms and see, instead of doing all of that repertorization by hand, you have a computer program that pulls in all of the remedies pertaining to each symptom. And if you learn how to use that properly, you can come up to a similimum in the different cases. If you have the professional version, you can save the cases and the analysis over time. So if you've got a patient who you've been seeing for a number of years, you can see their progress there and keep a tally of all the remedies that you have been given to them. We also have Dr. Deepak Sharma is my co-host on the Health In, and he has the Orbitz Clinic in India. And I don't want to forget Kavitha Kukunoor, the homeopath inspirational author. Just click the link there. And I'm going to bring back onto the banner, I'm going to make a new one for, Christina Chambreau is here already. Dr. Christina Chambreau, veterinarian, holistic vet, gave me a call. She wants to do some more shows. So tune in for that. We'll put out announcements. And I want to thank you so, so much for listening. And we will see you. Have a great weekend. And we will see you next Monday on the Health In, and then back here again Thursday at noon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Where people really care. Our past Let your truth be a girl. One